Before we get into this conversation here on Soundbites, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Welcome, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show. And Soundbites are a weekly look at food, agriculture, the environment, and energy. This week, this opening segment, we're going to take a look at what's going on in the EPA and NOAA. What is going on with the Trump administration and the dangers of the slashing of the budgets that are taking place and how it could affect everything from the Chesapeake Bay area, from where we broadcast from, to the entire nation. We're here with Alex Guillen, who is an energy reporter, is the energy reporter for Political Pro, where he covers the EPA, regulations, coal, as well as lobbying and campaign finance in the energy realm. Alex, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And Jackie Patterson joins us once again. She's director of the Environmental and Climate Justice Program with the National NAACP. And Jackie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here as well.
So one of the things when you look at what's happening here with the Trump administration, let's just take a step backwards and talk about the man who was named to head the EPA, Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General of Oklahoma. And Alex, let me begin with you, and then we'll go right over to Jackie. Just talk a bit about this man's entanglements, who he is, what his past is, and what he might portend for the EPA.
So Scott Pruitt, like you mentioned, was the Attorney General of Oklahoma from 2010 until he was confirmed last month. And in that role, he sued the Obama administration a number of times on lots of different issues, including things like Obamacare. But he really specialized in suing over environmental regulations, and particularly EPA. I think he sued EPA 14 times in total, and some of those cases are still pending, actually. So what that means is he sort of switched sides, in a sense, on those lawsuits. So between that and in 2014, the New York Times reported in a sort of a famous story now about a secretive alliance he had with oil and gas companies to coordinate messaging and their lawsuits against EPA. So we've known about that sort of thing for a few years. Some recent emails came out that further illustrated that relationship, but he's always defended it as saying he was representing the people of Oklahoma and their interests in working with the oil and gas industry. Now things are a little different. He's the regulator. He's on the other side. And obviously he's coming in and is under some orders to roll back a lot of these regulations. But he has a very unusual history with EPA that past administrators from both parties have not had.
And, you know, Jackie Patterson, one of the things I was thinking about was that in terms of the EPA, just a bit of history. When you think about the origins of the EPA, under a Republican presidency, under Richard Nixon in 1970, who was kind of pushed into doing this in many ways, given the tenor of the moment, and it's a very different world we're in. I think that, you know, if we could paint a picture of what the EPA might look like in the coming years, it could end up being a little literal shell of its former self, of itself.
Yes, sad to say. And what's unfortunate is that even at its peak, the EPA had so much opposition in terms of its mandate and its mission that it was underperforming in terms of what was needed by these communities, many of whom are living in these petrochemical toxic corridors. You know, community members are suffering from cancer clusters. So even when it was doing well, quote unquote, it was not doing well enough for certain communities that are suffering. So the notion of it actually being rolled back even further from its limited operations before is unfathomable.
Now, before I turn back to Alex, I want to hit a couple of themes here. I want to just pick up just for a moment, Jackie, what you just said. Because I think, you know, there's always been, not always, but there is a semblance of a disconnect between black activists and others and the environmental world. And we don't talk enough, I think, about, in a broader sense, the larger public, about the nature of environmental justice and how EPA's being kind of cut back, and we'll talk about that next, can really affect communities of color all across this country in devastating ways.
Yeah. quite so. I mean, already we have, just speaking of communities of color, African-American, across the board, 71% of African-Americans live in counties in violation of the existing air pollution standards. And so, again, that 68% of African-Americans live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant, which puts out emissions like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, arsenic, lead. I'm in Alaska right now in Anchorage where there are issues with one of these, the zinc mine here has been cited 600 times for its violations in terms of polluting the waterways that these Alaskan villages rely on for their water supply and for their fishing and so forth. So there's already such rampant and disproportionate impacts on indigenous people, on African Americans and Latino Americans and so forth, and not to mention low-income communities who are, for example, in Appalachian region where they're living in the shadows of mountaintop removal, where the blasting of these mountains results in dust that gets into their lungs, gets into their waterways, and kills off fish, and then even damages the foundations of their homes. I can just give example after example of the disproportionate impact of these actions on various communities and populations. And so that's already, not to mention when these protections are taken away. At least now there's some recourse. You know, the fact that the 600 times that the zinc mine was cited, at least it was cited for doing these things. And so now, not even to have that in place and to remove explicitly some of the protections for Alaskan villages and to roll back the Clean Power Plan, which would have addressed some of the impacts of coal-fired power plants and so forth and so on.
And there have been some specifics here, Alex, that have come up that are kind of really, I mean, let's talk about some of these things that could happen to the Environmental Protection Agency. And I'm going to get to the Chesapeake Bay in a minute because this is where we live and it's one of the major issues facing this country and our region especially. But when I read in Science Magazine that the Trump administration wants to cut spending for the EPA's Office of Research and Development by more than 40%, what does that mean? What would that mean?
So maybe it's helpful to take a step back and think about EPA's overall budget.
Okay.
The agency is, its most recent year was funded at just over $8 billion, which is fairly small for a federal agency. Around half of that money goes to states in the form of grants, states and cities and tribes in the form of grants for all sorts of things environmental. And the rest of that money funds EPA activities and salaries and that sort of thing. So when you're talking about that, I mean, it's not great. EPA certainly employs a lot of scientists, and budget cuts have been suggested for lots of offices across the board, research being one of them. So what that would mean is dialing back probably on a lot of the grants that go out to universities and state researchers, possibly with a higher focus on climate-related research, which has been a target of this administration. Donald Trump has been very vocal about his criticisms of mainstream climate change science findings. So, you know, you're looking at fairly major cuts to the agency. And when I say fairly major, I think I'm really underplaying it because these are the sort of cuts that make people who work in this world, their jaws completely drop when they hear this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So we also have an administration of people who are going to be managing the EPA who really do want to see it dismantled. The Heritage Foundation came out saying they want to see this cut happen every year for the next 5 years so it's not just gutted, but gone. And
right. EPA has certainly been an unpopular agency among conservatives over the last 8 years because the Obama administration used it to impose some pretty significant new regulations on a variety of industries, automakers, power plants, chemical manufacturers, the agriculture industry. So they're not big fans of it, particularly the focus on setting federal regulations as opposed to leaving states to work out environmental issues on their own.
So, I mean, as an organizer, somebody who travels the country with all of this, Jackie Patterson, what's a political response? Before we get into more heart of what's going on, I mean, what can be a political response? I mean, you have people who who you would think on some levels would be opposed to this, but they also see the EPA is getting away their jobs and all the other things that people are told. I mean, so what is the political response to this? And how's it being organized?
Yeah. So there's a lot that's happening around, folks are just kind of reeling from the magnitude of the impact on one hand, but on the other hand, people are starting to launch, you know, campaigns to have local ordinances. So in some cases, there's states where a local ordinance can be more stringent than the federal or even the state level regulations around pollution or emissions. And so that's a strategy that was used even with the closing of the Siskin Crawford plants in Chicago, coal plants. They applied a local standard in terms of the level of pollution that can happen locally. So that's one route that folks are starting to take and tying certain codes and zoning to those local ordinances. Certainly, folks are starting to gear up for a litigation-based strategy, just recognizing that the monitoring and enforcement is going to be coming from a federal agency as it has in the past. And so people are trying to figure out where there are courts where they can have some regulations or some safeguards put in place that are imposed by the court. Those are some of the examples. Some of the folks are just trying to negotiate with, you know, more friendly utilities in terms of some of the pollution that comes from those types of operations. Some folks are mounting more of a strategy around public increasing public understanding, so that when the next elections come around, there's more of an educated voter in the tolling booth around some of these impacts of federal of EPA and so forth, so that we can actually live to see a different day, and we can start rolling towards that now. So those are some of the things that people are doing.
And I wonder, Alex, in the work you've been doing in reporting this for Political Pro, I mean, talking to people inside the EPA, I mean, what's the tenor? What does it feel like inside there?
It ranges from indignant to worried. A lot of EPA employees feel somewhat insulted when the Trump administration, talks about how the agency has lost its way, is following its true mission, and has not been following the law. And on the other hand, they're looking at a 25% cut to the agency's budget and a 20% cut to the agency workforce. And they're looking at all these programs that they believe are important, and they're seeing them proposed for cuts, and they know they're in for at least 4 years of this. And so I think what you're seeing so far is a lot of people being worried, but it's still very early days in the administration. The administrator was only just confirmed a few weeks ago, still getting his footing. So we'll find out what their long-term response is. But folks in the agency are definitely generally concerned.
I mean, and I think with good reason. One of the things that was in the Washington Post, I think, last Friday, was that the Office of Management and Budget got a leaked report that said not just the EPA, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration could be cut by 17%. Which is a scientific agency that is part of commerce, but that it studies climate change, weather, or coastal systems, oceans. I mean, it cutting that back, what would that mean to cut that back? What would we lose?
You're talking about cutting back a lot of research, like you mentioned, that goes into, first of all, climate change, true. But NOAA also oversees the National Weather Service, which is important for everyday people who are checking the weather, and practically every industry that has to deal with Mother Nature. They want to know what's happening, and that agency does very critical work. It's probably worth pointing out just at this point that, you know, when the Trump administration is proposing all these major budget cuts to EPA and NOAA and every other agency, that's all it's really doing is proposing, because Congress, in the end, is who sets the budget. And who decides what money goes where. So they'll take these sort of things into consideration, but from early conversations with Republican appropriators on the Hill, they find these cuts to be pretty suspect in general. I'm sure they'll go along with some of this, but a lot of it is money that goes to states, and they're not eager to cut money that goes to states.
So, how do you take the political temperature there, Jackie? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to add that we actively partner with NOAA and Climate Central, and over the last couple of years, we've gone around and we've done trainings with Gulfport, Mississippi, with Pensacola, Florida, with Wilmington, North Carolina, all on anticipating the impacts of sea level rise in these communities and helping people to overlay social vulnerability indicators with these protected surging seas and the other tools that NOAA and Climate Central have developed to help people to know, you know, what kind of land incursion they're going to be experiencing. So for us, they played a critical role because, again, it's a number of our communities that tend to be in flood zones, tend to be underprotected by levees and so forth. And so they've been, you know, just undeniably critical to our mission around civil rights as it relates to sea level rise. And so for us, this was also deeply disturbing in those terms of rollback from NOAA.
Well, I mean, very specifically, I mean, I forget where I read this. I don't remember, Alex, it was one of your articles, another one. But Jackie, that when they look at the cuts that might take place at the Environmental Protection Agency, that the part of the agency that deals with environmental justice programs, they're talking about cutting by 79% to bring it down to $1.5 million.
Yeah, I read that as well in one of these articles, perhaps Alex's as well. And that's exactly why everyone, now we're actually talking about partnering with NASA, Union of Concerned Scientists, and others to work with our youth to develop what they call citizen science, but now in this context around immigration and so forth, we talk about community science, but where folks are actually starting to do these things for themselves and seeing that the very programs that would have protected us at all are not going to be there. We're just trying to figure out how we can start to step in and do some of these roles ourselves, whether it's putting air in a turn somewhere and monitoring those and trying to, again, figure out whether it's via litigation or local ordinance ways to address the findings through the community science projects that we're doing with youth in these communities and with universities in partnership.
And EPA was already not getting high marks on environmental justice.
Right.
A lot of
exactly.
Right. So high marks will go pretty low this time if this goes through.
Right.
Talk about, going back to politics for a moment. I'm going to pick up, Alex, again, what you were saying, and Jackie Patterson, I want you to jump in on this as well, obviously. But so it's not a done deal until the Congress votes on it. I think you said that many people representing the representatives don't want to see less money coming to their jurisdictions. But there's also this angst about the EPA in those, among those men and women as well, who might not want to lose money, but they also don't trust the EPA. So what do you think, and then both of you, what do you think the politics over the next couple months will be as they debate this budget about what might happen to the EPA? I mean, what were you alluding to, Alex, when you first said that?
Well, it's true. The EPA is considered sort of a big bad in a lot of states. But when it comes down to when you start breaking down into the agency and you look at the various individual programs, a lot of them are actually popular among Democrats and Republicans. And the Trump administration has proposed severely cutting or even eliminating some of those. That includes a popular program that funds upgrades for diesel engines, like really big engines at ports and places that contribute badly to poor air quality in cities. That includes programs like the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which is one of the biggest programs for sure that's been identified for cuts. And that's not going to make people happy in a number of states that voted for President Trump, Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio. That the Trump administration proposed cutting that program from $300 million down to $10. So you've got a lot of little programs that people like, and when they consider EPA overall, it's perhaps unpopular because of certain regulations. But the money that they dole out for things like brownfield cleanups and Superfund cleanups, mayors and governors really like that money. So those are the sort of programs that are probably much safer. Regulatory programs might be, might be a better focus for dialing back among Republicans on the Hill.
Jack, you want to add to that at all? But just how you see what's going on in Congress through the work you do?
Yeah, I mean, so for us, I guess there's a bit of a selection bias in terms of we work mostly with the communities that are most impacted who are most protected by the result, by the existing both programs, whether it's environmental justice, small grants that go to communities to help them to be able to address the environmental justice issues, there's cooperative collaboration grants that go out to these communities. And so for many of them, they're the only resources that are available, but there aren't that many foundations that fund environmental justice work. They're funding a lot of climate work, but not as much environmental justice in the traditional sense. So there's definitely that challenge that we're seeing. At the same time, we are also working with some of the industries on the front lines of, you know, whether it's the coal mining industries and others that are on the front lines of being concerned about the role of the EPA in terms of their industries. And so we're, through some of the labor dialogue, trying to work with industries around how to ensure that the transition that we're pushing for that's going to protect the planet and protect the communities who are affected by pollution are being equitably dealt with in terms of their livelihood and so forth. So I guess in some, we definitely see more concern and more support for EPA and its rules and regulations and safeguards than we do opposition. But in those cases where we do see opposition, we don't want to just kind of steamroll over. We're trying to kind of work through and figure out how to have the best solution for everyone.
So, and Alex, you know, I was, one of the things I was thinking about in all this was that when you look at what could happen here, literally, it could either stop or roll back enforcing clean air greenhouse gas regulations, coal and natural gas power plants, the Clean Water Act itself, cleaning up the bay. I mean, this could have a drastic effect on the environment. I mean, this is nothing for us to be sanguine about.
That's certainly a concern among a lot of environmentalists. It's worth noting that the incoming administration, while hostile to greenhouse gas regulations and some of the other air quality regulations that were put in place, they still want to work on cleanups for other regulations that have been put in place in the past. We'll see what happens. A lot is going to depend on whether these actions are actually upheld in court, because they are going to be taken to court. Everything EPA does is taken to court.
By somebody.
By right. Somebody, yes.
Right.
It'll be different people. It'll be different people now taking EPA to court.
Right.
Yes, by somebody. That's a process that's going to end up taking certainly most of the next 4 years.
And what are you thinking about in here when it comes to all this budget cutting and the possibility of pulling out of the climate treaty, Jackie?
You said, what am I hearing about the possibility of pulling out of the climate treaty?
Because we're hearing a lot of hemming and hawing in some quarters, but I'm curious where you think it is.
I do get the sense that it from all that we're hearing, that there is more of a likelihood that that will happen than not. I mean, Alex might have more to say on that. He's probably more of an inside track on Intel. But that's what I've been hearing. And we have a relationship with the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, with the Global Climate Justice Network, and all of these groups. And we actually have gone to the UN Climate Talks for the last 7 years, since 2009, with a big Copenhagen meeting. And we're there at the Paris Climate Talks when the agreement was passed. And so certainly we have an investment in seeing the U.S., you know, be able to really be a responsible neighbor to the rest of the world, and to make those commitments and to stand in joint action with other nations. And we've seen, when we were there at the U.N. Climate Talks in Poland, it was at the same time as Super Typhoon Haiyan was ravaging the Philippines. And we were there when Yeb Sanyo, the person representing that nation, was in tears on the floor of the UN Climate Talks while the various nations weren't making the right commitment. And I'll wrap up by saying that we know that the U.S. is 4% of the global population, but 25% of the emissions that drive climate change. And that's at a low from the previous 30%. And so we certainly hold that the U.S. has a responsibility to continue forward with this agreement. but and are deeply concerned at what we've heard in terms of more likely than not that they're planning on pulling out.
So Alex, is there what about some of the things I've read that say that more established mainstream conservatives are worried about the international dislocation if we pull out? Does that have any weight?
Well, there's a couple of potentially influential voices in the Trump administration that are urging him not to pull out of the Paris climate deal. One is Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who, of course, was former CEO of ExxonMobil. It may surprise people to learn that he would support staying in the deal. But, of course, it's, you know, the one thing gigantic multinational corporations want is stability. And he also, of course, has to consider our position with the rest of the world on many other issues. The other voice who is reportedly talking to the president a lot about this is his daughter, Ivanka, who has supposedly also been urging him to stay in the deal. The administration has not gone on the record yet about their plans for this. It seems like there's a lot else going on in the administration as they're starting up, so we'll see what happens. But pulling out brings with all number of problems, but it's not a binding treaty. There's no punishments for the U.S. if it doesn't meet its climate goals. There's no sanctions or anything. So, the negatives of pulling out, perhaps the Trump administration will decide, do not outweigh the benefits.
And how do you think that'll pan out? Do you think when you view this? I mean, I'm asking you to be prescient or look for a crystal ball, but do you think there's even a chance that the United States will not pull out of the climate agreement?
Yeah, I think there's a chance. It's possible. That's a fair assessment. But I'm not putting any money down on it.
if all these things come to pass, I mean, I'm thinking about the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, we've been battling in this area around the Chesapeake Bay, around the agreement and trying to enforce this agreement for 20-odd years, and it's not to where it's supposed to be. Part of the reason it's as close as where it's supposed to be is the oversight and push by the EPA over all these years, kind of forcing the issue. Without that there, I mean, what happens to things like the Chesapeake Bay watershed agreements, or what happens in the Puget Sound or the Gulf of Mexico? And I've read it again that San Francisco Bay projects would be eliminated. Almost $5 million, whatever they got, will be eliminated. So what happens to these programs? What will be the effect on these kind of very important environmental sanctuaries and bodies of water, Gulf of Mexico, Puget Sound, Chesapeake Bay? What do you think the effect will be?
It's honestly difficult to say at this point. We're talking about a fairly substantial rollback on regulation, possibly budget cuts to these programs. I think we're going to have to wait and see, and a lot will depend on the states who are involved in this and their successful lobbying on this issue, both on the Hill and at EPA. I think we'll see.
Exactly. And then for you, right. And Jackie, for you, it becomes a matter of what between the executive orders, what happens to the EPA, mm-hmm. NOAA, the people now who are control of the Senate, the House, and the White House. I mean, what could be the effect of organizing? Doesn't some of that organizing also take place in places that might not be ordinarily familiar territory or friendly territory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think so. Organizing already has already been under resourced and just overly taxed by all the many assaults, because there's already been so much control by industry over the various policies and regulations and systems that are supposed to protect communities. So the notion of A, having to do more of protection in those kind of even traditional areas, not to mention have to get up to speed on and understand these other areas in order to be able to be effective is certainly overwhelming. I think that one of the things I'm doing a lot now is talking to various universities, going around doing talks to universities about what their role can be in helping if we don't have some of the to the prior science-based entities from the federal level, whether, you know, whether it's NOAA or these other entities. And so some of the universities, we're talking to universities about how they can step up and be able to provide some of the science and the technology and the analysis that might be missing, I mean, that will likely be missing at this point, to be able to, and really have some strength in community campuses so that we can continue to organize under these, continue to organize and strengthen organizing under these worsening circumstances.
Well, I know in the coming weeks and months we're going to be calling on both of you a lot to kind of help us parse through this as things happen. You just heard Jackie Patterson, who's Director of the Environmental and Climate Justice Program with the NAACP, and Alex Guillen, who is an energy, who is the energy reporter for Political Pro, where he covers the EPA, regulations, and coal, lobbying and campaign finance in the energy realm. And Alex and Jackie, thank you both so much for being with us. I do look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back, folks. This is still Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our program we do every week looking at food, agriculture, the environment, and energy systems. And we are going to leap into a conversation here about the great one of the great debates taking place in Annapolis during this General Assembly session, which has to do with fracking. There are folks who want the fracking to be banned. There are folks who want to continue the moratorium. The folks who want all that lifted and say, let us frack. So we are in here, studio, with Mitch Jones, who's a senior policy advocate for Food and Water Watch, and Drew Cobbs, who is executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council. And Drew and Mitch, welcome. Good to have you both with us here on the Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be back.
Thank you.
So where are we? Drew, I'll let you start. Where are we in terms of the political battle and these three different ideas about whether we should have a moratorium, banning fracking, or let fracking fly? So to speak, in Maryland. Where is this debate at the moment, and where do you think the political reality lives?
Well, I think we're in the middle of the debate, and the session is really starting to crank up now that it's almost two-thirds over. So the fun's really begun, and things are getting down to work now.
So what does fun mean to you, Mitch?
Fun can be said in many ways, as Aristotle would say. Well, you know, as Drew indicated, we're in the middle of things. Yesterday, Wednesday, the fracking ban in the House moved off of its second reading and to its third reading.
Is that in committee?
That is on the floor.
On the floor.
So there was a debate. Delegate Shane Robinson, who used to be the sponsor of fracking bans several years ago, was the floor leader in the debate. A couple of amendments were offered. Those were rejected by the House, and the bill is moving to its final vote in the House this week, either today, Thursday, or Friday. And then we'll see what happens. On the Senate side, there hasn't been any movement yet. There was a hearing, I guess that was just last week, and, you know, at the moment, we'd been told early on, I believe actually at the Annapolis Summit, Mark, by Senate President Miller, that the House would pass a ban, and then we would see what the Senate has done. Well, the House is on the cusp of passing a ban, and so we're going to see what the Senate does. But I think, you know, things are moving, and as Drew says, it's fun.
So, Drew, to take it from your side of the aisle, I mean, so to speak. I mean, so if the House has passed the ban out, clearly that's not something you support, and we don't know where's the Senate going to go, and what's your thought about the debate taking place at this moment in the House?
Yeah, I mean, no real surprise. Truthfully, I always thought, especially the House committee, that they were predisposed to pushing a ban. So that's really nothing surprising there. I think the Senate's a little more reluctant to go that far and maybe, you know, considering other options.
Well, to me, talk from your perspective, Drew, for a moment, the industry perspective. I mean, is a moratorium okay with the industry at this point? Do you see it opening up, and what do you see the potential? I mean, Well, I mean, where do you see all this, and how does it affect you and the people you represent?
Well, I think right now, we've been under a moratorium here in Maryland, and it's basically only Western Maryland that companies have had any interest in at all, and that interest is somewhat subsided, and that's been partially a factor of what's happening in the marketplace. There is a softening of prices of natural gas because there's a significant supply out there. So there has not been the interest at the moment, in Maryland or a lot of other places, truthfully.
I mean, so is this, are you saying this is like not a top priority for you?
Well, I think, want to have that option open, possibly in the long run. And since, basically all Marylanders are benefiting from fracking, I think it's being a little bit hypocritical when you were going to ban the practice, even though we want to continue to get gasoline and natural gas and other products, that come because of fracking, and that, the supplies increase because of that, and also the prices become lower.
So, and Mitch, so where is it for you? I mean, it is Western Maryland on some levels. I mean, and so let's say it's only a moratorium, but I think that there are, if you look at the maps, let's just talk about this one. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, I think you're right in what you say, Drew, that just in terms of the profit margins for gas, it's very tough at the moment because it's a glut, right? And so you're not seeing a whole lot new. And so we have this Marcellus Shale, which is huge. But the reality is we don't know what the future brings. And there really are, I don't know how easy they are to get to, but you've got the Culpeper Shale, you've got the Delmarva Shale on the Eastern Shore, you've got the Gettysburg Shale coming in from right around Frederick and Westminster. You got the Taylorsville Shale coming up from the south for Prince George's County and then Charles County, areas like that.
Right.
So, I mean, eventually, when we talk about fracking, it's not just Western Maryland.
Yeah, that's true, Mark.
Right?
And that is true. Andrew is correct that the only place where there has currently been interest that we're aware of, where people had been trying to get leases, I've heard rumors about elsewhere, but I've never seen anything definitive, has been the Marcellus Shale. But it's important to note that the Taylorsville Basin, which begins we'll be prejudiced and say it begins in Maryland and goes down to Virginia instead of beginning in Virginia coming up to Maryland. That basin has actually had leases in Virginia from companies that are wanting to do exploration there to see about the prospects of drilling. No drilling has happened there yet that I'm aware of, but there are people exploring the possibility of the Taylorsville Basin in Virginia. I think were fracking to be allowed in Maryland, it would only be a matter of time before that basin in Maryland would also be targeted by industry. It is correct that there is a glut currently. There was a glut in natural gas now for a while. Prices are very low. I checked actually just before walking over here, and it's trading at about $2.90 right now, which it would be very hard for anybody to make money on here in Maryland. But we should also realize that it's not just where the drilling would take place that makes this a statewide issue, but the fact that there is the infrastructure that goes with all of the drilling. So should drilling, fracking come to Maryland, there would have to be additional infrastructure at the local level. That's going to mean roads and the well pads themselves. But beyond that, it's going to be new gathering lines for the gas that's coming from those wells. It's going to be new compressor stations that help to transport that gas to probably Cove Point, which has been converted or is being converted into an export facility to send the gas that we're producing in this country to other countries to help their economies to build products that then we would re-import here. So, the issue is a statewide issue already, even if the first place fracking would likely take place would be the Marcellus Shale.
So if the potential, if the economic potential is that huge, Drew, I mean, doesn't it make a huge difference whether it's a moratorium or versus a ban or versus getting rid of it all for the industry?
Yeah, let me jump in, Mark. As I said, I mean, this is in some respects much bigger. The first point I want to make about the Taylorsville Basin, which is probably the next biggest possibility, is dinky compared to the Marcellus Shale. It's equivalent about maybe 1/400th of what the Marcellus Shale is. So, yeah, is there potential gas there? But obviously, if you're going fishing, you go where the fish are, and that's the Marcellus Shale. And for the foreseeable future, you know, that's where the interest lies. You know, there has been no interest anyplace else in the state, you know, as far as developing any other resources. And, you know, obviously, the Marcellus Shale is the second biggest natural gas play in the world. So that's where the interest lies, and that's where there is. Now, as far as infrastructure, as far as Cove Point, there are already contracts for that gas and what will be exported out of there. So, you know, I don't want to say this in a way that it just, like, that's just a threat, that that's a concern, but that's already been taken care of. There are contracts for those gas to be export and that. And it doesn't involve, nor was it reliant on any natural gas being produced in Western Maryland.
But so I'm just curious from both your perspectives. Well, let's take a step backwards for a minute and then come into where we think this is going politically and why it's important or not important to both of you and the people and the interests you both represent. So just very quickly for our listeners, what are the arguments for and against this again? Most people have heard this before, making sure everybody understands exactly what we're talking about when it comes to fracking, whether it is being to open the door for fracking or to keep the moratorium alive or to ban fracking. So, well, I mean, what to me are the what for you all are the fundamental issues about what should take place and why? Either one of you. I mean, neither one of you are shy men, so it's okay. Go ahead, Drew.
I'll be glad to jump in first. I mean, the other thing is this issue is much broader, and I, you know, Mitch's group, Food and Water Watch, they're against fracking anywhere, anytime. You know, so they're totally opposed to fracking. So this isn't just a Maryland or Western Maryland issue. This is a national, international issue for them. They are just against that process. Now, this is the process that right now, roughly about 70% of the natural gas that we get comes because of fracking or come from frack wells. According to the United States Energy Department, 95% of the new wells for oil and gas are fracked. So this has been a huge thing for domestic energy production. The United States is now the number one producer in oil and natural gas because of this technology and also horizontal drilling, but because of those technologies. So as I say, I've heard no one ever complain to me that they're unhappy with paying a dollar or more or less per gallon for gasoline or for their utility bills or gas bills on that. So this has been a huge thing as far as supply and a huge benefit to, you know, American families.
You know, Drew's right. Food and Water Watch is opposed to fracking. We don't, you know, hide that any more than the oil and gas industry hides the fact that they want to frack everywhere, as long as they can make a profit. So, you know, and the reasons why are clear. It's because fracking has been shown that it can cause and does cause damage to local water supplies. The evidence continues to grow in peer-reviewed scientific literature that the air pollution associated with fracking has negative health effects at folks living near wells. In addition to that, we're concerned about the effects of climate change and the fact that continuing to burn fossil fuels is going to exacerbate the climate change, which we believe we're already seeing. And we believe that instead we need to make investments in solar and wind, truly clean renewable energy, and build out that infrastructure instead of making capital investments in infrastructure that's going to lock in fossil fuels for another 30 or 40 years. So, you know, for us, the question is very broad. It's planetary in the sense of climate change, but it's also very local in the sense of the people whose living rooms I've sat in while they tell me the stories about how they can't drink their water anymore. So this issue touches at a very local level, and it touches at a global level. And so, yes, we are opposed to fracking because we do not believe that for our future, it is the right policy for us to be pursuing, not only here in Maryland, but anywhere.
Where are we politically with this? I mean, it's really confusing to me. I mean, so you've got, I mean, I know that there are certain committee folks and people who run committees that are not, that they've kind of not completely anti-fracking. Some are, and some are pro-fracking. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so where are we? I mean, the governor clearly, I think, is being ambivalent to an extent. Because he doesn't want to get into this fight.
He's avoided so far in this session saying anything other than in 2015 a bill was passed that required me to do regulations, and I've done that.
And it was very clear required him to do.
Right.
Right. So where are we politically with this? I mean, what do you think? I mean, the tenor I seem to think is that here is that the moratorium might pass, which the industry would like, and that maybe that people don't like fracking would like, but that the ban is not going to happen because it's just too tough a political issue to get through.
You know, I don't believe that for a couple of reasons, Mark. One, in, you know, Drew is correct when he said that the House passing the ban isn't really a surprise. I think at the beginning of the session, we all anticipated that. What is a surprise, though, is that when they voted out of committee last week, the vote was 18-4. There were two members absent. It was 18-4. With four Republicans voting in favor of the ban in committee, when the moratorium, which was just a three-year moratorium, when it came out of the House committee, it was a three-year moratorium with a health study, passed 16-6 with only, I believe, three Republicans. And in fact, it may have only been two Republicans in committee. So actually, this ban bill had, coming out of committee, more bipartisan support than the moratorium had 2 years ago. I think that's a significant fact that perhaps has been overlooked by people. Obviously, the bill hasn't passed off the floor in the House yet, so we don't know what the final vote looks like. In terms of the Senate, this has always been the trickier proposition for passing a ban. But, you know, at the hearing on the ban legislation, the chairwoman, Senator Joan Carter Conway,
from Baltimore City,
asked point blank some citizens from Western Maryland, if we were to pass a ban, you know, her argument is if we pass a ban, the governor will veto it and therefore you'll have fracking. She asked the citizens, given that scenario, given the idea that if we pass a ban, it might be vetoed and we might not be able to override the veto, would you still want us to pass the ban? The citizens said yes. And I think that caught her off guard. And we haven't yet seen where that's leading to. Now, I personally don't necessarily believe the governor will veto a ban, but, you know, like I said, we haven't, it's still odd enough to say at somewhat early stages in the Senate. We know the House will be passing a ban this week, and then we're going to see what the Senate does. But I would not discount the possibility of seeing some form of a ban begin to move there.
And so what do you think about that? I mean, is that a possibility from your political perspective?
Well, hey, anything's a possibility. The General Assembly's in. So for another 33 days or whatever, who knows? But, you know, I think the other thing is just trying to strike a balance. You know, a ban and this or this whole anti-fracking or thing is, I think, extreme position. I mean, that's going out there considering what's happening. 24 other states have this activity. None of them have banned it or outlawed it, including this. That includes California, of all states, you know, that is fracking. You know, so none of those have stopped. And there have been over a million wells fracked. And have there been some issues? Yeah, absolutely, there have on that. But it's relatively small in nature. And the benefits to both the country, and I also cite the environmental benefits. You know, Mitch touched on the issue about carbon. Well, the only reason we're going to make our carbon plan here in Maryland by 2020 is because of natural gas supplanting coal for power generation. That's why we're going to get there. It's a significant element of why we'll accomplish the goals we set forth for reductions in CO2. So, and not to mention the other pollution have been significantly reduced over the last 10-plus years, you know, as far as ozone levels down 17%, NOx down 24%, and particulate matter down 30%, all because natural gas replaced coal. So we're breathing cleaner air, and there have been all sorts of other benefits. Natural gas is the bridge fuel for that. And the renewables, solar and wind, can't function properly because they're intermittent sources without natural gas. It's the perfect complement for them to do what they do because the sun's not always shining and the wind's not always blowing.
So feel free to jump in, Mitch, here, but yeah. I'm curious also that where do we think the president is on this, President Miller?
He has said in the past he didn't think a fracking ban will pass. He said that the House could pass a ban and the Senate will see what they're going to do with it. I'm not privy to Mike Miller's thinking, unfortunately. Maybe fortunately. You know, maybe Drew has had conversations with him recently and knows what he's planning to do. But I think, you know, they were waiting to see what the House was going to do, and then they were going to determine what they were going to do in the Senate.
Drew?
Yeah, must admit, I don't know about his thinking either, and nor would I even take a guess or make a prediction.
So before we conclude, I'm curious what you just said, Mitch, and that's been an argument been made that there is no way that technologically speaking, that we could catch up or be prepared for solar or wind or any other renewable to take the place of gas at this point. That if you wanted to take the place of gas, we're talking about a pretty long arc of time, a decade more before that could even begin to happen.
Well, banning fracking doesn't ban natural gas. What we're saying is that we need to stop building new natural gas infrastructure now. I mean, Oil Change International put out a report at the end of last year, or the beginning of this year, which showed that we basically have to begin, we have to stop constructing new fossil fuel infrastructure now if we want any chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change. Nobody that I know of is saying immediately turn off the peaker plants. What we're saying is stop building new infrastructure, stop building new plants, and stop fracking. And in the meantime, put our resources into look, it would have to be massive. Nobody's going to deny that. It would have to be a real concerted effort to build wind and solar and also some storage in order to have a truly clean energy system. It's possible. Many scientific studies have looked at it. The University of Delaware did a study and showed that you could, in the PJM interconnection, which is technical, but basically it's the electrical system that includes Maryland, that you could, using wind and solar, if you overbuild capacity of generation, account for 99.9% of all hours with just wind and solar and a small amount of storage. So it's possible. It is technically feasible. What isn't there right now is the political will to enact that agenda, and that is something that we at Food and Water Watch are working on in conjunction with our work to ban fracking.
So,
and the other factor is obviously the cost of that endeavor would be huge, and the consumer impact would be massive. And so those are a lot of the concerns. And once again, just trying, is anything in politics, you know, is trying to strike a balance or a compromise of what's reasonable and where can we get from here to there.
And is the vote tomorrow on Friday?
Last I looked, it had not yet been published yet. So it's possible it's taking place this morning. If not, it would be tomorrow on Friday.
Well, we clearly
by the end of the week. I think I agree.
By the end of the week. So we'll come. We're going to be coming back to this in the coming weeks and before the session is out to see where this goes and keep this conversation going. Drew Cobbs is executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council, and Mitch Jones is senior policy advocate at Food and Water Watch. As we continue to keep watch on the issue of fracking, will it be allowed? Will it be banned? Or will the moratorium continue? We shall find out, gentlemen. Mitch and Drew, thank you so much for taking your time.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.